Okay, well, thank you very much for the invitation, Tom. I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to talk to this group. Now, the outline of my talk is here in these 5 points. I'm going to first give some introductory remarks about the extraordinary growth of the credit derivatives market from almost zero a decade ago to where it is now. Then I'll talk about the valuation of CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, the portfolio credit derivative, in terms of a calibrated static model. Now, we're using a risk-neutral pricing approach, and as you all know, I'm sure, risk-neutral pricing is pricing relative to market prices. So calibration is a principal issue, in particular with respect to CDOs, there's a problem with some difficulty because there's a large number of different credit derivatives referencing the same portfolio, and you really have to calibrate to them all in order to do accurate valuation work. Next, I'll talk about the development of a dynamic model that's built onto the static model, and the advantage of this approach is that with this dynamic model, you can make use of all the calibration properties of the static model so that the dynamic model you get is automatically calibrated to all market prices of your underlying collateralized debt obligations. Furthermore, the dynamic model itself is easily calibratable to dynamic sensitive derivatives on the same portfolio, such as collateralized debt obligations, or such as options on collateralized debt obligations, particularly types of forward starting CDOs and leveraged super senior swaps, which I'll talk about in more detail. So as I mentioned, this is a British Bankers Association survey carried out in 2006, and the total global notional outstanding of credit derivatives has grown from almost zero in 1996, a decade ago, to about $20 trillion today, or even a little more, and to the point that it's become one of the most important markets in banking. This survey, 2006 survey, was brave enough to make a projection for 2008. I put a big, this is an added question mark, and everybody knows why I've added that question mark. We've had a global credit crunch in operation since July, August of this year, and any predictions made before that time were sort of subject to some, let's say, uncertainty. Now, along with this extraordinary growth in the credit derivatives market, there's been a very profound change in its character. Initially, the market was almost entirely dominated by single name credit default swaps, which are today considered relatively banal instruments whose pricing and risks are relatively well understood. Whereas today, you can see that these portfolio credit derivatives, full index trades, synthetic CDOs, tranched index trades, together dominate the single name credit default swaps. So that these portfolio credit derivatives, now, in general, they're much more complex, more difficult to understand. There are many interesting questions. It makes it a good subject for research, and yet, as we've recently seen, a very difficult subject for risk management. At any rate, it's an interesting topic to discuss, and there's a lot of research by individuals going on in this area. Some further remarks, as I just mentioned, collateralized debt obligations have been prominent players in the global credit crunch. Just about every financial newspaper magazine that you open these days has another article about CDOs, oh no, or something like that. My last example will be leveraged supersedure tranches, and these are probably the most common asset underlying the Canadian non-bank asset-backed commercial paper market, which is currently undergoing some difficulties. It's currently frozen, and it's very serious for the credit picture for business in Canada. So the development of methods for valuing these portfolio credit derivatives is still very much an ongoing process, and I'll present a model which I happen to particularly like and which I've done a lot of research on. Okay, just to get started, I'm going to give, just in case there are people here who don't know perhaps what a CDO is, I'm going to give a very simplistic view of what a collateralized debt obligation is. You can imagine a bank, and banks take in deposits, and they lend out money, say, to corporations. And you might imagine a bank that's got a certain loan portfolio. It's made, say, 125 different loans. That's the reference portfolio. It might have loaned a few hundred million dollars to Alcan, a few hundred million to General Motors, a few hundred million to France Telecom, and so on. And it suspects that over the next period of a few years, say 5 years, there are going to be a certain number of defaults. It doesn't know quite which names will default, but it's expecting to have some defaults. And it wants to insure itself against a certain slice of those defaults. And it can do it in the following way. It can tranche, so it can do what they say, tranche the losses. That is, it can buy insurance from an insurer, or an investor if you want to call it, on the first 3% of the losses due to default, which would occur in this portfolio as a whole. Doesn't matter which names default, but the first 3% of the losses, it wants those insured. So, or it can buy insurance on the next slice, the 3 to 6% tranche. And I've shown here what are called the standardized ITRAX tranches. You don't have to select the tranches in this way. This is just one particular way of doing it. So let me go into that in a little more detail. Let's consider the 3 to 6% tranche. And let's suppose the protection buyer protection against default losses, that's the bank, buys insurance against all losses from 3 to 6% of the total notional. In return for this insurance, the protection buyer pays a regular quarterly premium to an investor, a certain percentage of the notional. And the investor pays any losses lying between 3 and 6% to the protection buyer. So from the point of view of the bank, it's getting insurance against the losses due to default. From the point of view of the investor, buying this insurance on the tranche is something like buying a bond, a corporate bond. The investor gets a quarterly coupon payment, as he would in a bond, and the investor must pay any of the losses to that tranche in the case of default, just as the investor in a bond doesn't get back the full principal in the event of default of the bond, the investor pays losses on the bond. So that's the basic idea. That's the object I'm going to be talking about. So I hope everybody has got that in their memory. Now, this ITRAX portfolio that I've just mentioned, ITRAX as a way of designating a portfolio of 125 different names. The underlying assets here are credit default swaps. It doesn't make any difference. Credit default swaps have losses just like loans do. And the ITRAX Corporation has identified 6 different tranches on which they have standard insurance contracts. The 0 to 3%, 3 to 6%, and so on. And they've identified the 4 different maturities for the contracts, insurance for 3 years, or for 5 years, or for 7 years, or for 10 years. And one of the advantages of standardizing things like this is they were able to set up a market for these contracts on the different tranches with different maturities. And so there's a fairly liquid market for these 24 different contracts, six tranches times four maturities. And so on a daily basis, you can get quotes of the quarterly payment, 26 basis points for a three-year contract on a 3 to 6 percent tranche. This line is displayed somewhat differently, as you can see down here. Don't worry about that if you don't know about it. So I was fortunate enough to get a small database from the Julian Rutan Fortis Investments, and all the data that I talk about here will be taken from this particular database. Now, I'll be talking about risk-neutral pricing, and it's important to remember that risk-neutral pricing is pricing relative to market prices. And as we've just seen, there are typically 24 different CDO contracts on the market that reference the same underlying portfolio. So it's important to find a risk-neutral measure that can be calibrated to reproduce all available market prices. Your ability to use your model to price other derivative instruments is dependent on the calibration process because you're pricing them relative to other market prices. So once you've got your model, you can use it to price, to mark tranches to market, to price forward CDOs, and to price a wide range of different derivatives on the same underlying portfolio. Now I'm going to talk about a few details about how I develop this this static model in such a way that you can calibrate it easily and efficiently to all these different market prices. So let's suppose you just have a CDO contract of a given maturity on a given tranche, 3 to 6%, 5 years, say. And you want to know what a fair quarterly payment is, what a fair premium is. Well, a fair premium is determined by the fact that the expected value of the losses that are paid to the protection buyer should be the same as the present value of the expected premium payments made by the protection buyer. Okay, and the premium payments made by the protection buyer on the right-hand side, they're equal to W, the coupon rate per year, times the effective number of years over which these premium payments are made. And the important detail which comes out of a more detailed study is that this equation can be evaluated for tranche K. I've numbered the tranches K from 1 to 6. This equation can be evaluated if you know this function f of k and t. F of k and t is the expected loss per unit tranche notional for tranche k at time t. So if your knowledge of these f of k and t's for all tranches k and for all times up to the maximum maturity defines the static model for the valuation of CDOs. And pretty well every model that values CDOs has to go through the process of somehow or other getting in the function f of k and t and then using it to evaluate this equation. Now, a very common way of doing this, perhaps the most common, is to use, say, the Gaussian-Kapler model, don't worry if you've never heard of it, to calculate this function in f of k and t. And then you get f of k and t in terms of the individual default rates of the individual names in the portfolio and the correlations between them. And the problem here is that any reasonable correlation structure is far too complicated to deal with, and the ones that have been tried so far give an f of k and t that's too restrictive to be able to calibrate the model to all all available market prices. So, the question is, how do we choose an F of K and T that's sufficiently flexible that it can be calibrated to all available market prices? This is the first main new idea of the talk. Well, at least it was new a couple of years ago when the research was first done. Now, if I want a very general function F of K and T, I should try to construct an arbitrary, I should try and get a construction that will give you any function F of K and T that's consistent with the with its definition. And that's what I've done here. So this is the expected loss for tranche K at time T. So for the 3 to 6% tranche, one thing you know about losses is that losses increase with time. So this function has to be monotonically increasing. Another aspect of the fact that losses increase with time is that losses hit the 3 to 6% tranche before they hit the 6 to 9% tranche. You know, as you go, you accumulate the losses. The first losses hit the 3 to 3%, the next losses hit the 3 to 6%, etc. So that the function for the 3 to 6% tranche has to lie above the function for the 6 to 9% tranche, and so on. So I have here a construction that numerically is able to produce all functions F of K and T that are consistent with that definition. We take a number of discrete times. You can make this grid as fine as you like. I usually make it fairly coarse, doesn't seem to make much difference. And I use a piecewise linear continuous function. So any such function can be specified in terms of its heights at the selected time grid. And the fact that losses are increasing functions of time means that this height is bigger than this height. So that's a linear constraint on the heights. And the fact that this tranche is riskier than tranche 3 here means that this height is bigger than that height. Another linear constraint. The fact these constraints are linear is absolutely critical to efficient computation. So evaluation of the basic pricing equation then can be easily carried out by an optimization procedure subject to these linear constraints. And the model is easily calibrated to all available market prices in that way. So calibration is really very fast and efficient and extraordinarily accurate. Here's an example of how it works. I've taken the data in that table for all the tranches, and I plotted it for maturities 3, 5, 7, and 10 years on this chart. And in addition, I've used cubic spline interpolation to determine points at all integer maturities between them, and then a rather arbitrary extrapolation to get an extrapolation to 1 and 2 years. Now I try and calibrate the model to those 60 price points, and the calibration turns out to be perfect in this case. So that's very impressive in comparison with the Gaussian copula model, which can be calibrated to exactly one market price at one particular time.
In some cases, it doesn't satisfy that constraint that the higher tranche would have higher loss than the other tranche.
Ah, that's because you have to read the good eyes. That's because of the scale of the basis points has been modified to get everything on the same graph. So, yeah. But, yeah, everything is in order. Okay, so this calibration procedure has been very extensively tested. I tested it originally on a set of 97 daily sets of iTrax quotes that I got from Fortis, and then somewhat later, Torresetti, Brigo, and Palavicini tested it much more extensively on calibrating to over 1,000 daily sets of both CDX, the two standard indices, CDX and ITREX quotes, and found that the calibrated model reproduces the tranche prices to within the bid-ask spread, and often very, very much better. If they aim at reproducing the midpoint prices, for example. So once you've got that model by calibrating to these underlying prices, then you can do some very important things. One sort of obvious thing, but very important to the industry, is marking tranche prices to market. Let's suppose you bought insurance 3 months ago and the spread was 60 basis points. Well, today, the price, the spread for the same insurance is the market price. It may have changed from 60 basis points to 65 basis points. What's your original tranche? What's your original contract worth in today's prices at today? So you have to calibrate your model to today's prices, and then you price it relative, you price the mark-to-market value relative to all the market prices, and you need them all to do an accurate job. You can also value long, short, forward tranches, and for the details, I'm going to refer you to articles which I'll give references to at the end. How much time have I used? About 25 minutes? Or? Okay, thank you. So here's another application which was I just put in here because of its current interest. Let's suppose you have a bespoke portfolio. Now, a bespoke portfolio is not something that's traded as an index. Okay, it's a bank which has a certain loan portfolio of some names which are determined according to the people the bank is loaning money to, and there may be credit default swaps on each of the names, so you can calibrate the index to a portfolio of credit default swaps, but there's no market for tranches. Okay, so the question is, how constrained are the tranche prices by no arbitrage arguments if all you know is calibration to the index? And I've done that little calculation. I've considered the 10-year equity tranche, 0 to 3% tranche, priced in terms of an upfront percentage U plus 500 basis points. So that value of U varies between minus 41% of the total notional and plus 72%. You don't really have to understand what I'm talking about to understand that this is an enormous spread. So the risk-neutral pricing really does almost nothing for you in valuing the any of the tranches of a bespoke portfolio, and that's what you find in a lot of reports in the newspapers and the financial press, is that the liquidity has gone out of the market, and particularly for bespoke portfolios, you can't find buyers for them. And nobody knows how to value them, even from the point of view of marking them, of finding their losses. But the only thing you can do here is, of course, risk-neutral pricing is not the only thing you can do. And perhaps a sounder way, in many respects, if you don't have a market, is you have to get your credit analysts together, do a sound analysis of balance sheets, of default prospects, and so on, and see what that's worth to you and add a risk premium. That's another way of doing it, and that's what people have to get together and do on these bespoke portfolios. Okay, now I want to build a dynamic model on top of this static model. The static model has been really all that's necessary for derivatives on the market up to now. Before the credit crunch, there had started to appear some dynamic sensitive derivatives, and the leveraged super senior swaps that I'd mentioned, which are so prominent in the Canadian ABCP market, are one of these, and I'll talk about that as an example. So there's going to be much more emphasis probably on dynamic models, assuming CDOs and their ilk have a future. So the first thing to do here in developing a dynamical model is introduce a loss grid. Okay, let's take L1 to be 0, L2 to be a loss of 3% of the total notional, L3 to be 4.5% of the total notional, whatever. You have a certain number of discrete loss points. And you can, again, make this grid as fine as you like. But you want to make it as coarse as you can get away with for computational efficiency. And then you put this loss grid down at a number of You put this loss grid down at a number of different times, from 0 up to t, t plus 1, t plus 2, etc. And what the static model tells you is it tells you the probability p of kt, the probability that the loss is k at time t, for all nodes on this time and loss grid. What the static model doesn't tell you is it doesn't tell you how to get from one time to another. And in to do that, you have to put some... Oh, thank you very much. To do that, you have to have a dynamical model, which you might specify in terms of the transition probabilities, say a Markov model. So Q here, I've tried this type of binomial type of Markov model, or one-step Markov model, in which you have a probability Q of making a transition with no loss, and a probability of 1 minus Q of making a transition to the next loss step. Now, these Q here is a function of the node you're starting from. So there's a different Q for each node. Now, it turns out that you can solve the Kolmogorov equations, and you can find a set of Qs that take you from one node to the next for a given set of Ps derived from a loss model. But the Qs that you get, don't forget, the Qs that you get, some of them may be negative in some cases, and some of them may even have magnitudes bigger than one. So this is not a satisfactory model. What you have to do is you have to have a model that you can not only solve by solving these dynamical equations, but you have to constrain the Qs, the transition probability, so that they actually represent probabilities. And you can't always do it with this one-step Markov model. So that's not a satisfactory model. So the next thing I tried was a multi-step model in which you allowed, from any given node, you allowed transitions without loss or to any loss that would be higher than the initial starting point. That would be the most general Markov model going from time t to time t plus 1. And that turns out to work. In fact, you can prove that you always get a solution for simple 1, 2, and 3 state models. I've done numerical proofs for, say, 700 different cases. You always get a solution. And I've conjectured, therefore, that there's always a solution. If somebody good at linear programming or programming with constraints wants to take a crack at it, I think it's an interesting problem to prove that you always get a solution. And the important thing is these Ps aren't just any Ps. They must be consistent with the fact that losses increase with time. So that gives you constraints, and those constraints are very important in the analytical solutions that I have obtained. So that's the model. And all you have to do is implement it, and you've got a nice dynamical model for pricing dynamic sense derivatives. So let me give one example, which is a very great current interest to people in the Canadian asset-backed commercial paper market. This is leveraged super senior swaps with loss triggers. Now, what's a super senior tranche? It's a tranche which is very rarely likely to get hit with losses. Say, there are lots of losses in the 0 to 3%, 3 to 6% tranches, but for, say, industrial grade, investment grade loans, it's very portfolio. It's very likely that you'll get losses. Very unlikely that you'll get losses, even the 12 to 22% tranche. So they're very risk. They're not very risky tranches, and as a result, the coupon payment that you get paid for investing in a super senior tranche is very low. Might be a few basis points, 10 basis points. So that's not a very attractive investment to the investor. So in order to get something that's a little more attractive to the investor, what has been devised is a leveraged super senior tranche. And in these leveraged tranches, the investor is only liable for a certain posted collateral. It's a fraction of the notional of the tranche. So, say 10% of the notional of the tranche. U is a 10. Okay, so the investor's happy, but now the protection buyer is unhappy because the protection buyer is paying that coupon on the full notional, and yet risks only getting a tenth of the losses, up to a tenth of the notional in the event of default. So what is done to resolve this problem is one puts in a loss trigger. You can have triggers of different kinds. I'll consider a loss trigger. You can put in a loss trigger, and it works this way. That the first time the total basket loss exceeds the trigger value K, and this trigger value is placed well before any losses hit the senior tranche, the contract is wound up on a mark-to-market basis. And to the investor in that sort of contract, this is where I think the real risk lies, because that loss trigger is going to be triggered well before there's any losses to the tranches. And in that case, the investor has to pay out losses depending on the value, the mark-to-market value of the contract, and these losses might be up to the full value of this collateral. So it's important to understand that risk. Another risk is that these are dynamical products, and the market for dynamical products is not very deep at the moment. So comparative pricing is difficult, and there's a lack of liquidity, so there's obviously that has to be built into your view of the product as well. I got about 5 minutes. Okay, thank you. Since I've got a little bit more than 5 minutes, I'll have a drink of water. Okay, I've just plotted out here some of the results which I've calculated with the model, the model I described to you. And and as a starting point, this model has been calibrated to all tranche prices, all 60 prices that I showed in that figure a little while ago, from June 21st, 2005, which is a date, one of the dates I happen to have market prices for. And using that calibrated model, I've produced these curves. So these curves, the fair spread on the leveraged super senior tranche depends on the degree of leverage or the fraction U of posted collateral. And it also depends on the value of the loss trigger. So what about the value of the leverage? You can see that as you reduce the posted collateral, the fair spread goes to zero as the posted collateral goes to zero. And that's entirely reasonable, because when the posted collateral is actually zero, the protection buyer gets essentially zero payment in the event of losses. There's no collateral. Okay, so that limit's fine. Then, when the loss trigger is decreased, turns out that at a given posted collateral, the fair spread increases, and it looks like it's tending towards the fair spread for the underlying super senior drawn spread, which is 12.5 basis points. And then another point I should make is that I've just selected one particular dynamical risk neutral measure to do these curves. The dynamical market is very much like the tranche market. You need a pretty deep dynamical market, many calibration to many different dynamic sensitive derivatives to very much constrain the tranche price. So there's quite a wide range of prices you may make. I just shown one example. So risk neutral pricing here, just because you've got a model, doesn't mean that you're out of the woods with respect to finding reasonable prices. These prices, initially for all dynamics instruments, have to be market prices. It's the market that's king. Risk neutral pricing just interprets it and interpolates when you've got a deep enough market to do so reasonably. I think my voice is telling me something. Okay, let me just conclude. I think there are two main ideas here. One is how to construct the static model, easily calibratable to all market prices for CDOs. And the second is how to build a dynamical model, which makes use of the information you gained here. And this dynamical model is also easily calibratable to a wide variety of dynamic sensitive derivatives. And calibration is a key issue that I've been concerned with. I gave an example of a leveraged super senior swap, and anyone who wants further details, I've given a few references here, and you can find, if you can't copy these down, you can find them on my website. Don't forget to type in Department of Physics, Michael Walker. A bit unusual. Okay, thank you.